It's a pleasure and an honor to be here, and I would like to thank Professor Schreiber for his introduction and for his invitation. What I'm going to try to do today is give you a very quick and very rough overview of some of the arguments that they develop in my book, and I hope you will excuse the fact that I'll speak in English. I've changed slightly the title to Barbarity and Intimacy in Violence in Civil War, because I believe that these are two characteristics that a lot of thinkers, but also a lot of the people who work in the areas of civil war, are puzzled by. And what I'd like to mention is that there are many reasons why political thinkers, since a very long time ago, probably since Thucydides, have emphasized or have thought about the problems related to civil war. But certainly one of the issues that has mobilized their interest has been the question of violence in civil war and the characteristics of violence in civil war. And one of the elements that they've emphasized very much is the barbarity of the violence, the fact that civil wars tend to produce a type of violence that is very brutal. And Arno Meyer, who is a historian of Europe, has characterized this type of violence as the deepest and most infernal of violence. At the same time, the second characteristic that seems to have puzzled a lot of observers has been precisely the fact that civil wars have what has been very often described as fratricidal character, what they describe as the intimate character, the fact that civil war takes place very often between people who have interacted in one or another way together, sometimes either as citizens of the same country, but very often also as neighbors or members of the same city, very often also as members of the same family, even in some exceptional circumstances as brothers. And this is where the metaphor of Abel and Cain, the fratricidal metaphor, comes in. So the question that I would like to address today is how to explain those two characters, and also to try to figure out whether there is a way to provide a theoretical and empirical explanation that explains both at the same time. We have a lot of attempts to characterize violence, either in terms of its brutality, very much fewer in terms of its intimacy. I would say that most of the thinking that goes around the question of the intimate violence in civil wars is restricted in the areas of literature, maybe psychology, but not so much political science, sociology, or the other social sciences. So what I'm going to try to do today is provide an account of violence in civil war that accounts for both at the same time. And just to give you a very brief this description of the intimate character of violence, this is a picture of a high school in the early, late 1980s in northwest Bosnia. It's from a memoir of a person who took part in the war, and the characters with numbers are students of that classroom that got involved very in this the war in Bosnia from both sides, and very often were involved in processes of victimization of people with whom they had this intimate association of having been members in the same high class, high school. So let's start with the question of barbarity. It sounds at the outset intuitive, it's much more difficult to define. Well, the first thing that I would like to mention is that when we think about barbarity, we tend to think about atrocity, about brutality, about excessive violence. But these things are very difficult to define in an objective way, and the reason why is it so is because these are very culturally subjective perceptions. The best examples I can give you would be that for Western societies, everything that entails the use of a knife or a sharp object in the process of violence is considered as atrocious, but at the same time, we seem to have a much better and much less critical view of ways of killing that involve, say, mass bombing from a distance or aerial bombing, even though the killing can be as, if not more, atrocious. So the ways in which we perceive violence are not constant through history and through cultures. And I think this is a problem because very often what we describe as atrocity is not necessarily what others would understand, and vice versa. The second area in which people think in terms of atrocity and violence is the area that entails numbers. Killing a lot of people seems to be a characteristic that qualifies violence as atrocity. But then we have a problem, first because a lot of interstate wars have killed a lot of people. And also there are a great number of very small civil wars. I use the example of Chad. I could bring other examples in which violence has not been that big in terms of numbers. So it's very difficult to say that civil wars are distinct in terms of the numbers of people who get targeted. In fact, if one looks at the distribution of conflict in the post-1945 period, one would notice, obviously, that the main type of armed conflict, of militarized armed conflict in that period, has been internal or civil war as opposed to interstate war. And this is why the interest of scholars has focused so much on civil war, because it has become the main form of large-scale militarized confrontation. But this is a problem insofar as civil war is not a new phenomenon, and what in fact has happened is the decline of interstate war following the end of the Second World War. So in a sense, civil war is a residual category. It's what remains when this other form of interstate violence, namely interstate war, has ebbed. And in a certain way, our interest in civil wars is an artifact, not so much of the fact that civil wars have become more dominant, but of the fact that interstate war has declined. And that has colored our understanding. So if we want to capture the idea of atrocity, I would say we would have to emphasize two things. The first one is the perception that civil wars are somehow more atrocious. And this is a perception that is constant throughout history. People always compare. And that includes people like Montaigne or Adam Smith, who have very often reflected about these issues. And in every comparison they make, they emphasize the more atrocious nature of civil war compared to interstate war. And the second subject, the second dimension, which is a bit more objective, is the targeting. Who is targeted? And it is true that at least in the civil wars following the post-1945 period, after the end of the Second World War, we find that non-combatants, civilians, have been the primary targets. So I would emphasize those two dimensions, the non-combatants as victims on the one hand, and the fact that there is a very strong perception of civil war violence as being atrocious. And this very strong perception, I think, is associated with the intimate character of violence. We think that violence in civil war is barbaric because it's intimate. And even though it is the case that in most civil wars, not every person is killed by people they know, that this is a characteristic that indeed distinguishes civil wars from interstate wars, in which the people involved in violence are strangers, do not know each other, and the violence becomes and has an abstract quality. So let me go over a number of conventional understandings of violence. We have a lot of facts. The newspapers, the magazines are very often full of descriptions of violence, but these facts tend to be very unsystematic and very untheorized. So there isn't much of a systematic analysis, and usually the way in which people describe these kinds of processes entail descriptions such as madness, hatred, or evil. But these are at best descriptions, they're not explanations, they're not good enough. And so what I'm going to do next is to show you how I attempted to reconstruct four distinct intellectual traditions that try to grapple to understand and explain precisely the character of violence in civil war. So the first one we may describe as Hobbesian. This is the idea that violence in civil wars is particular, has this particular form, which is the barbaric form it takes, because of the anarchy that emerges in situations of civil war. So it's the absence of authority that creates, that brings out the true nature of humans, which is bad. And when humans are left to their own devices, they fight against each other. It's the war of all against all. This is a very simple and very rough characterization of Hobbes' idea. And in the most recent formulation, this is an argument that has been associated with the description of civil wars following the end of the Cold War as new wars. In books, popular books such as Hans Magnus Enzensberger books, for example, the idea that violence is gratuitous, that people fight about nothing, anarchy just produces through this channel of bringing the bad out of people, barbaric violence. Then there is a second category, as popular as Hobbesian, the Hobbesian understanding, which I call Schmittian from Carl Schmitt, the idea that civil wars are very much about the clash between incompatible ideas or incompatible identities, very much along the lines that Professor Margalit mentioned yesterday. So here the idea is that civil wars are so barbaric precisely because they bring to the fore the most extreme form of incompatibility, of perceptions, ideas, and identities that cannot possibly be compromised. And the most recent attempt to apply this kind of idea in a non-systematic way, of course, is the popular understanding of ethnic conflict, the idea that ethnic groups very often cannot coexist because of these incompatible perceptions. Then I'm going to mention two more intellectual traditions that are not as popular as the Hobbesian and the Schmittian. The third one I call Foucauldian, from Michel Foucault, and this is the idea that violence in civil wars is so extreme because the idea of sovereignty, in a sense, is so sacred and so symbolically important, and therefore transgressing sovereignty by challenging it brings out the most extreme type of violence, precisely because it's viewed as the most extreme type of violence in the context of at least modern authority. And the most recent example of that is a number, for example, of attempts to explain the reaction of the United States after this September 11 terrorist attacks and the way it has really overdone its reaction by, for example, justifying practices that have been described as torture. So this is the idea here is that this barbaric process is a reflection of this challenge of sovereignty. The fourth and final tradition is what I call Clausewitzian tradition, and this is an idea that emphasizes not so much the content of civil war as the form. It is a particular form of war that has the ability to bring out the characteristics I described, and the most one, this is what I take into my book, but a very common description would be the description of guerrilla war as dirty war. So the idea of dirty war very much comes out of this perception of the particular form of warfare. So how do we go forward from that? One solution would be to take each of those intellectual traditions and analyze them extensively, but I'm not going to do that today. What I'm going to do, rather, is take the last one and push it to its logical extreme. Why? Because I think that all of those traditions have elements of truth, but also all of them have weaknesses. For example, to refer to the Hobbesian tradition, it's not true that civil wars really produce anarchy. What they in the sense of absence of authority, what they produce very often is a proliferation of authorities. And this is where a lot of violence is produced. It's also not true that polarization is the source of the violence very often. It may be the result rather than the source of the violence in many cases. It is also true that elites may have incompatible attitude much more than everyday people. And it's also true that intellectuals tend to see everything through an ideological frame, whereas simple villagers very often may not share these types of opinions. It is also not true that it is only the sovereign who uses barbaric violence. Very often violence comes precisely from the other side. And if one looks various statistics about the distribution of violence, even though states tend to kill the majority of people in many civil wars, the violence between states and rebels is equally divided. And finally, it's not clear how we can connect, even though a lot of people point to the relation between warfare and violence, it's not clear what the connection is. So, as I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the fourth tradition and develop it and try to show you that by focusing exclusively on it, we can come up with an explanation of both barbarity and intimacy. And I would like to motivate the talk with two pictures. This is a picture, it's called the xylography, it's an etching on wood. And it represents a scene from Athens during the Second World War, during the occupation of the country from German troops. And what you see is a practice that was known as a blocking of a neighborhood, in which a neighborhood that was suspected of harboring rebels was encircled. All the men were assembled in the central square. And then you can see at the middle of the picture, there is a hooded informer who points to particular people who are singled out, and some of them are executed. And you can see both the figures of the German soldiers, but also you can see in the outskirts, the people who are encircling the neighborhood are wearing this particular uniform, the F-zone uniform, which is a Greek military traditional uniform, and these were members of a collaborationist militia. So I think this picture in its simplicity, includes all the characteristics I'm going to mention today. And to show you that this is not just an isolated phenomenon in history, this is from a picture from Tal Afar in Iraq in 2005 and shows precisely the same kind of process. A local Iraqi is pointing out who among the men who have been arrested by American troops are suspected of collaborating with the insurgents. And this is a description from the Washington Post article that published this picture, in which those people who collaborate are described as sources, and very often those sources do not appear to be very credible. As a US officer said, you obviously can't just go by what they say because they make plenty of mistakes, but since we don't know these places as well as they do, it helps to have them around. So that's the basic idea that I'd like to discuss. Let me give you some facts about civil wars. The majority of them, not all, but the majority, are what we may describe as irregular or guerrilla wars. And the characteristics of those wars is that they have front lines. These front lines, they don't have front lines, I'm sorry, the front lines are not clear. And this absence of front lines allow rebels to blend into the population, to hide. In other words, what emerges in these kinds of contexts is what economists describe as information asymmetries. Civilians have information. They very often know who are the rebels or who may collaborate with the rebel side, but the armed actors who seek those people do not. So the main argument that I'm going to propose here today is the idea that the causal link between civil war on the one hand and the barbarity and intimacy of violence on the other hand is precisely these informational asymmetries that are generated in the process of irregular war. And my argument is going to be that you can explain the characteristics of violence and the patterns of violence just by looking at that without considering things like ideology, preferences, and other factors. So it's a parsimonious and it's a reductionist analysis, which is precisely intended to show how much we can get from a very, very simple abstraction. So I'll give you a few definitions and a few concepts. I'll discuss very briefly how I understand the process of irregular war and how I understand violence in that process, and then I will conclude with a quick empirical demonstration. So a minimal definition of civil war would be any situation in which armed combat takes place within the boundaries of a recognized sovereign unit among members and parties that are subject to a common authority prior to the beginning of the hostilities. It's a very, very broad definition intended to capture as much as possible. And that includes armed combat that has to rise over a certain threshold. Sovereign units are, in the modern times, are states, but they could be anything else. It's compatible with any cause. The civil wars do not have to have a particular cause, ideological, ethnic, or otherwise, and includes wars that are usually described as wars against resistance against occupation or colonization. A more precise term would be internal or intrastate war, but we use the term civil war precisely because it's so common in everyday language, even though the term can be very tricky. So what I'm going to mention today applies to irregular conflicts, that is conditions and to conditions where violence is coercive and it is bilateral. So I'm not going to discuss, and these, you know, the best examples you can think would be Afghanistan today or Chechnya a few years ago, for example. And this does not apply to cases where violence is unilateral, just the state has the ability and kills people who don't resist. And it does not apply to situations in which violence is used to exterminate populations or to expel them, as opposed to control them. So it wouldn't apply to cases such as Bosnia, to Rwanda, or to the purges by Stalin. So this is the main scope condition. We can think of two basic actors. I call them incumbent actors and insurgent actors. There may be multiple insurgent actors. The logic does not change. As I said, there are no clear front lines. You cannot easily depict, as I'm going to show, a country in civil war as the countries in interstate wars with neat collars on one side and the other side of the front line. And the key concept is the concept of divided sovereignty. The idea that is that monopolies of violence are localized. They do not disappear, they exist, but they're localized. And the main problem that emerges in these kinds of situations is what I described, we can call it the identification problem, the idea being that you don't know who the enemy is and you have to find a way to recognize them. This is a map of El Salvador in 1984. You can see how difficult it is to depict this type of wars on a map. They look like mosaics, they look like patchworks, they don't look like cleanly divided maps. And this is a similar map of South Korea, which also had a guerrilla war at around in 1951. And again, it shows the complexity of the process, the fact that you don't really have front lines. There are two types of divided sovereignty in a situation of civil war. One type we may describe as segmented, and the idea here is that within a pre-existing state, you may have two states operating quasi-independently. If you look at Sri Lanka today, it is one sovereign state officially, but in fact, within its territory, there exist two states, the Tamil Liberation Tigers, in part of the island, run their own state with their tax collection agency, draft, etc., completely unimpeded, with the exception, of course, of the military clashes when they take place. But another form of division of sovereignty is what we may describe as fragmented sovereignty. And this is the idea that people may experience a very confusing reality in which they have to respond to two competing sovereigns at the same time, who make demands that may not be feasible, demands of allegiance to one side and to exclude the other side, which may not be practical for individuals who live in these kinds of situations. And related to this concept of divided sovereignty, I use the concept of control, which from the perspective of the armed actor is the ability to control a territory and to deny access into this territory to the competing, to the rival actor. The main question that this setup brings is how to understand why people collaborate or support one or the other side. And this is a very vexing question because it lies at the core of the discussions of civil wars. And there are two ways of understanding collaboration and support. One is to think of it as attitudinal, what people really believe, which is very difficult to implement or to study because in situations of civil wars, people have incentives to falsify their beliefs for obvious reasons. And the other way, which is the one I adopt, is to focus on behavioral support. What do they do as opposed to what do they believe? And very often, as I said, what they do is not necessarily a reflection of their true preferences. And I think we can, by simplifying, we can point to two sources support in situations of civil war. One is to look at the causes, the factors that are related to divisions before the civil war begins. So you may have different ethnic groups or you may have different ideological groups and people belong to those, and this is what explains why they prefer one side over the other. But the second factor, which people tend to ignore, is that as the war goes on, the armed actors have the ability to shape the behavior of people precisely by using violence, so that very often people behave in ways that are not consistent with their preferences or are different from these preferences. And very often, in the long term, they may even have the ability to change those preferences. So in a sense, you have an exogenous source of preferences and behavior and an endogenous source. And the more a civil war lasts, the more likely is that the endogenous sources are going to prevail over the exogenous sources. And I think that's a very important factor because in our understanding of civil wars, we tend to think of a civil war as a black box, and we tend to use factors to explain it that are derived exclusively from the pre-war situation. So my claim today is that we have to understand how these wars actually change, transform people, their beliefs, their behavior, their attitudes. The question that follows is how is this targeting taking place, and how do political and armed actors attempt to solve the problem of identification question? And there are two ways they attempt to solve it. The first way is the easy way, and this is to say we're going to target people collectively and assume that everyone who is a member of a specific group is suspect. If the group is suspect, the individual is suspect. And very often this uses profiling characteristics such as ethnic group membership. Other times it uses visible identifiers. For example, in the Spanish Civil War, the nationalist side knew that in certain areas workers were likely to be leftist, so they used to look at the hands of people, and if they were rugged, they were likely to be workers and therefore suspect. It was exactly the opposite in the French Revolution. The French revolutionaries looked for very soft hands because those indicated aristocrats. But at the same time, and this we may describe as indiscriminate violence, indiscriminate in the sense that it does not discriminate individuals. It focuses on groups. Very often, a criterion that these kinds of organizations use is location. If people come from a certain area, live in a certain village, they are considered to be suspect. The alternative is what I call selective violence. And here the idea is to generate individualized information. The idea is to capture people who are guilty, quote unquote, of certain actions, as opposed to people who are just members of a certain group. And if you go back to the two pictures I've shown you, they are both instances of selective violence, of a process that is used to generate individualized information. And you would be surprised how much individualized information is produced in these kinds of conflicts. This is just from a notebook from a German officer during the German occupation of Greece in the 1940s, and they have a lot of these kinds of very, very detailed biographical information about specific individuals. In many of those conflicts, this kind of information tends to be produced. So one reason why this type of distinction matters in civil wars is because in civil wars you have more than one actor. And if people are treated badly by one actor, they may turn to another one. So there are strategic implications of violence, precisely because violence is bilateral. And therefore, that means that armed actors have to take into account the consequences of their behavior. Indiscriminate violence tends to be counterproductive, because if people are not given a choice, if they're just targeted because of who they are but not of what they do, then their best protection is to join the other side. And that is why in situations of civil war, very often selective violence is much more effective. As a US advisor in Vietnam said, this is a political war and it calls for discrimination and killing. And this is the problem with selective violence is it creates moral hazard problems, right? Because this symmetrical asymmetry, these informational asymmetries generate a situation in which people have an incentive to provide information to armed actors for all kinds of reasons. And I'm going to read you a description by Eamon Collins, who was an officer in the IRA, an intelligence officer, who said that after a while, one aspect of my encounters with people and their complaints began to depress me. I realized that a lot of people, often not even Republicans, would seek the help of Sinn Féin in order to draw on the threat of IRA muscle, so they hoped, in solving their disputes. At times I felt as if people were treating me as a mafia godfather. One former war colleague asked me if I could sort out his son-in-law. Apparently the latter was beating up his wife, my former colleague's daughter, and I said that it was none of Sinn Féin's business. Then my former colleague said, "Yes, it is. That man is never out of the police station. I'm sure he's an informer." I said that he was making a very serious allegation, and I said that if the IRA were to investigate it and find it to be groundless, then they would come looking for the person who made that allegation. Unfortunately, the allegation that so-and-so was an informer was never out of the police station became one that I heard regularly from people who wanted extreme violence done against their neighbors. So what this passage illustrates is the tendency of people, civilians, not killers, who are involved in civil war processes to use the opportunities for information that emerge in order to settle accounts that have nothing to do with the war and its politics. And I call that process the process of joint production of violence. It's joint because precisely the act of killing is the tip of an iceberg that very often includes the process of aggregating information from a variety of sources, both armed and civilians. And in a sense, we can think of selective violence as a joint process which emerges through primarily the process of denunciation, which is what creates this problem of moral hazard. To give you another example of denunciation, let me mention a few things. It seems that its supply exceeds demand. Political actors, especially states who request denunciations, get much more than they can handle. It is very interesting that one of the first laws to be, one of the amendments to laws when the Nazis took power in Germany in the after 1934 was to make the arrest of a person on political grounds not a cause for divorce, because a lot of people, a lot of especially wives, were denouncing their husbands in order to be able to get a divorce. The implication here is that intimate violence in civil wars is not necessarily, as we would think in a Schmittian way, an aspect of politicization of every aspect, of every dimension of private life, but exactly the opposite, that is the privatization of politics. So the question then is, how can we go from these insights and analyze violence in a more systematic way? And I'm going to show you, before I do that, an example of how pervasive these kinds of practices are. This is from the first page of the Wall Street Journal, just 1 month after the September 11 attacks. It turns out the FBI, in just 1 month, received 435,000 tips from the population about terrorists. And if you read the article, there is a quote from an FBI agent saying that there are more men in jail right now because an ex-wife or an ex-girlfriend decided to rat them out. So these practices of denunciation for personal, local, or all kinds of other reasons are very common and can be mobilized in any kind of context. So turning now to how we can use all this information in a sort of systematic empirical fashion, let me show you how I try to do that. The way I did was to think of geography as a variable, as a factor that can be turned to the advantage of the student of these processes. And we can divide space in five zones. And the idea here is zone one would be the space where the incumbent actor, say the government, has very, you know, total power. And zone five, the symmetric to that, the place where the guerrillas, the rebels, have total power, the liberated zones. So zones two and four are zones in which either the government or the rebels have hegemonic but not total control. And then what is very interesting are zones three, which is where both sides coincide and coexist. And this would be the epicenter of civil wars, the front line, so to speak, of civil wars. These are the places very often described by journalists as places where the government rules by day and the rebels rule by night. So people are exposed to contradictory demands by two sovereigns. And so the argument here is that collaboration can be understood as being a function of control. People will help the side that has more power, independently of what their true preferences may be. And if that is true, then we should observe that collaboration is very high with one side in zones one, and then with the government goes down as you move away from, say, the city, where the government is very, very strong, and the opposite for the rebels. And what we would find in the epicenter in zone three is people collaborate with both sides because they have no choice. In terms of denunciation, it's much more difficult to capture because we don't really find a lot of records of denunciation, but we can think of it as a function of counter-denunciation. Think about the hooded informers. Why are they hooded? Because they fear retaliation. And also because they are known, because they are members of the community. That's why they have information, right? And so they put the hood in order to avoid being retaliated against. But what is true about small communities and villages is very often a lot of the disputes are very well known. If a person disappears, it's very easy for everyone else to guess who was the personal, the local, or the political enemy of that particular person. So the insight here is that individuals will denounce only where one side has so much power as to be able to thwart counter-denunciation, retaliation by the other side. That would be areas one and two for the government side, four and five for the rebel side. And here there is a very interesting prediction which I developed from a model, and that is in areas in which the two sides have control, people should not denounce each other. Why? Because they fear the retaliation of the other side. It's a bit like nuclear deterrence at the level of the village. It's mutually assured destruction. So you don't do anything against the other because you know that the other has the ability to hurt you, which is an interesting result. That is, at the epicenter of the civil war, you should observe no violence, because no selective violence, because there are no denunciations. What would be the predictions of that idea? Well, indiscriminate violence will be likely where and when information is very limited. So the government should target zones 5, the mountains, and very often they just bomb them, or they go there and burn every village. And the rebels should target zone 1, and this is where you have terrorist operations with bombs killing people at random. But selective violence would be primarily concentrated where control is hegemonic. Because where control is total, there is no need for violence, because everyone has to comply. So you would expect to find a lot of killing from the government side in zones 2, and a lot of killing from the rebel side in zones 4. And then you wouldn't expect to find violence in zone 3. So these are these very simple predictions that follow from this logic. So how do we test that? I'm going to show you very quickly before concluding the way I did it. I conducted a regional study in southern Greece. Why? Because it's very difficult to get data on these kinds of issues. And so on the one hand, we have studies that are very detailed of particular events, for example, the Srebrenica massacre. And on the other hand, we have large studies of countries. But in between, we have almost nothing. So what I wanted to do was to reconstruct the story of one area, to count every victim, and to catalog every story about victimization in that particular area. And I did that in this area of the Argolid in southern Greece that included 62 villages, about 45,000 people. The civil war turns out to have coincided with the German occupation, but it was a civil war because both sides were composed of Greek factions. And it was characterized as the ideological, left versus right. To give you an example of the analysis, what I had was to divide every period of activity, of military activity, in order to code every village for control. And as you can see, the areas in the mountains were controlled by the rebels, and the areas in the plains were more in the hands of the government, and then to also figure out which areas were places where violence was taking place. This is an overview of the incidence of indiscriminate violence. The circles capture the magnitude of violence, and the black color captures insurgent, the white color captures incumbent violence. And what you see is, first of all, that incumbents are more likely to kill indiscriminately because they had no information about the outlying villages. You can see the outlying villages are being places where the violence is concentrated. The stars are the villages in which there was no indiscriminate violence. And you can see also the two villages where there is rebel indiscriminate violence were villages that collaborated with the other side and suffered massacres. So the logic of indiscriminate violence is a logic that is easy to extract from a map like that. This is not the same with the logic of selective violence, which seems not to conform to any pattern. What we see is that the violence is divided between the two sides, and that it takes place pretty much everywhere, and it's also divided more homogeneously. It's not as heterogeneous as indiscriminate violence. You don't have a lot of big massacres, but a lot of people who are killed on an individual basis. But in terms of numbers, if you add those numbers, they're almost as big as the numbers of indiscriminate violence. But if you look at the historiography, only indiscriminate violence is recorded. So there is a tremendous selection bias into what makes it into history books. The other thing that I discovered was that the rebels were as likely to kill as the occupation forces and the collaborationists, which has landed me into some trouble in Greece. If you disaggregate the violence in terms of control, what you see is a pattern that is confirming the theoretical expectation. That is, most of the killing in zone 2 is by the government, most of the killing in zone 4 is by the rebels, and there is much less killing in zones 1, 5, and 3. If you were to map the two, you would see that the insurgent violence centers on 4, the government violence centers on 2. To show you just a few extensions, this is an ongoing project on the Vietnam War. The Americans were coding extremely intensively the level of control of all the villages. This is the Mekong Delta in 1969. The red villages are the villages controlled by the government. The blue villages are the Viet Cong villages. An interesting feature that emerges from the map is how the river seems to be associated with government control. So you see how geography allows power to be projected. But at the same time, you see how complex the reality of guerrilla war is on the ground. And this is the pattern of Viet Cong violence for which there is data. And you can see that it peaks in villages of Zone 4. This is from 60,000 bi-monthly observations in 1969. So the same pattern that we observed in Greece seems to be taking place in other conflicts as well. So there is a sort of trans-historical, trans-national logic at work. And this is just to give you an example of patterns of denunciation from work that I've been doing in Colombia. When we ask people how, what kind of information makes it, and these are interviews with former combatants. The kinds of motivations they provide are very much motivations pointing to a lot of personal disputes and local conflicts that then get translated into violence. So the underlying logic seems to be very common. So what I have shown, let me summarize some of that. So as Shakespeare said, there is method to madness. There is a way to understand even the most extreme processes in a systematic fashion. And I think it's possible to analyze these micro-level patterns of violence in a systematic way. And the argument here, my findings conform to the logic that I described, which is a logic that is primarily strategic and corresponds to a context of incentives and constraints that are associated with the character of warfare, namely irregular or guerrilla war. This context explains a lot of the barbarity of civil war. The dynamics are associated with the logic of informational asymmetries. But this context also helps make a lot of sense of the intimate character through the process of denunciation. In other words, what I hope to have shown is that the Clausewitzian perspective that is very, very simple makes a lot of sense in helping us understand both the processes of barbarity and intimacy in civil war. A key implication is that politics may often be epiphenomenal in situations of violence. I'm not referring here to the causes of the civil war. I'm referring here to the logic of the violence within the civil war. A lot of the violence that seems to be primarily or purely political may not necessarily be so, may be related to factors that have anything to do from criminality to other kinds of issues, but then get connected to the politics of the conflict. Of course, this connection may then turn and may change the identities of people, precisely because one of the reasons, the most powerful reasons where people form identities is the reaction to violence. Revenge, both as an act of violence but also as an act of identity transformation, is essential. When you ask people why they became, say, communists in Greece, it's because somebody killed them, killed members of their family from the other side. So violence transforms identities. And then a non-informed observer may conclude that those identities caused violence, so may reverse the order of causation. And I think it's extremely important to disentangle and open up the black box of war in order to understand all these very complex and messy dynamics. And I think, to conclude, that strategies of intervention in civil wars have to take into account these kinds of processes. So it may not be primarily, the most important issue may not be to solve the political conflict at the level of individuals, even though the political conflict has to be addressed at the level of collective actors, but there may be a need to take into account questions of security, questions of information, and questions of these micro and local dynamics of violence in designing strategies of intervention, especially in contexts of peacekeeping and peace building. People who seem to participate in these processes very often either are aware of the ground dynamics but may dismiss them as being too messy, and it's not clear how they fit in processes of reconciliation at the national level, or they may not know how to bring the two together. I think one of the most fruitful areas should be to incorporate these kinds of local dynamics in processes of intervention. So I'll stop here, and thank you very much for your attention.
Would you like to adjust it?